today, so you should find her here. She wanna talk to her. She'll be at UW tomorrow. So if you really wanna talk to her, you should go across the park tomorrow. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So as you said, I'm Megan Grella from the University of Chicago, and I'm going to talk about galaxy clusters, particularly at radio wavelengths today. And particularly I'm asking the question, are strong lenses overconcentrated? And other cosmological questions as well. And as we introduced before everyone got here, this is the Sanyaev-Zildjian array, the SZA. I'm going to say Z. I'm sorry, I know I'm in Canada. So I'll talk more about the instrument later. So here are the collaborators I've worked with on this particular work. So my advisor is Mike Gladders, and John Karlstrom is my second advisor, basically. And this is the SZA collaboration. And there are also members of the Red Sequence Cluster Survey collaboration and a Sloan Giant Arcs collaboration on this. And these are all, there are even more members of those collaborations I haven't included. These are all people who've been really involved in this particular work that I'm talking about today. Just to give a little bit of background, I wasn't sure whether people had galaxy clusters in the forefront of their mind today, but a little primer, just to remind you that galaxy clusters, just the term, is kind of a misnomer, because obviously most of the mass in a galaxy cluster is actually in dark matter. So I have a little pie chart showing how really most of the mass is in dark matter, and then there's also a large component of gas, hot intercluster medium, the ICM, and then the smallest component really is in the galaxies that we call galaxy cluster. And galaxy clusters are very useful for cosmology because they're the largest collapsed objects in the universe, and so you can use them to trace the growth of structure. These plots here show how, basically they show the mass function of galaxy clusters, which is like the number of galaxy clusters for given mass as a function of mass. On this plot, M200 here is the mass defined such that the mass inside R200, which is defined so that it's the radius at which the mass internal to that radius, the average mass in that is, the average density in that radius is 200 times the critical density of the universe. And so this is basically one of the reasons people define M200, use clusters in terms of M200 and M500, different overdensity radii, is that it ties into that clusters, when you talk about galaxy clusters, you really are talking about, in the context of a theory that's self-similar, so that there's only really one parameter. And so the size is related to the mass in a straightforward way. And so when you specify the mass, you effectively are specifying most of the information there is to know about the galaxy cluster. So these plots show for three different redshifts. So this is like 1.5 and 0, how this mass function evolves. And the solid lines are for lambda CDM cosmology. And each of the dashed lines is a different cosmological model in comparison to lambda CDM cosmology. And so you can see that measuring the mass function does constrain the underlying cosmology does affect the cluster mass function. So we'd like to measure this mass function, and in order to do this, you need a sample of galaxy clusters, and you need to know their mass, and you need to know their redshift. And really, one of the hard things to measure here in this, I mean, the main piece of the game to cluster cosmology is measuring the mass. So there are a number of different ways that we measure cluster mass. A few in the optical. So at optical wavelengths, one of the most striking things, obviously, is that there are all these beautiful galaxies there. And at some level, the more galaxies there are, the more massive the cluster is. And so people define different ways of measuring a cluster richness, which is basically like how many galaxies there are. Now, people define richness in different ways, but one thing that people often do is that we observe that the galaxies and galaxy clusters are have a passively evolving stellar population, so they tend to be red and dead, that's what we call them. So in order to cut down on projection effects of other galaxies that could be messing up your richness measurement, often people define richness of red galaxies rather than just richness of any colored galaxies. And another thing I want to point out here is that Often clusters have a brightest cluster galaxy, kind of like a central galaxy in their centers, and these can be very useful when you're studying them as well. I'll talk more about them later. Another optical mass measurement that you can make is the velocity dispersion. So you can measure the red and blue shifts of galaxies that are moving around the cluster potential and determine what the mass is that they're orbiting around. And so that's another mass observable. Another mass observable in the optical band is lensing. So there's strong lensing such that when you have a source behind the cluster, the light, as it passes through the deep potential well, gets bent, and you form these, you form multiple images of the same object, or you can form these giant arcs around the object. And so using these different strong lensing images, you can then reconstruct what the mass is in the cluster. Another measurement you can make on larger scales is weak lensing. So out here, where the density is not quite as high, you won't get strong lensing images. But statistically, the shapes of the background galaxies will still be distorted by the mass. And so on a statistical level, you can calculate what the shear is and get the mass from the weak lensing shear as well. And so those are some of the optical observables that we use to measure cluster mass. In the X-ray, we can see the gas that's in the hot intracluster medium, which emits at X-ray wavelengths. And so you can use either the X-ray luminosity, or you can also use measure the spectrum in the X-ray and get a temperature measurement of the gas and then use hydrostatic equilibrium to calculate what the mass is. And finally, the Sanyaev-Zel'dovich effect is another way to measure the mass of clusters, and I will talk about that more in my next slide. So the Sanyaev-Zel'dovich effect, which I'm going to call SZ, and you may call SZ or SC as you like, is a spectral distortion in the cosmic microwave background that happens when the CMB photons pass through this hot intercluster medium, and they scatter off these electrons in this medium. And so it's basically this spectral shift. So this plot shows this shift. So this is the original black body CMB spectrum, and you can see how the SZ effect shifts it over so that in this talk, I'll be talking about observations that we conduct at 30 gigahertz and 90 gigahertz. And at these lower frequencies, basically this shift results in a decrement so that at the positions of clusters, we see a hole where the cluster gas is scattering the photons to higher energies. And here, this is just, this is the same thing as this plot, but subtracted. And basically, in this talk, I'm going to be talking about the thermal SZ effect. There's also a kinetic SZ effect that has to deal with the peculiar motions of the galaxy clusters with respect to the CMB, but I'm not going to talk about that here. It's harder, it's much smaller and has a different spectral dependence. But so what we're observing when we actually are measuring the SZ effect is this change in the temperature of the CMB. And so as you can see in the equations here, so this F term is just the frequency dependence, which is given by this. And but this other term is basically the Compton Y parameter, and that's proportional to the pressure integrated along the line of sight. So when you think about what are you actually measuring with SC, it's basically the integrated pressure. And the integrated Compton Y parameter then integrates that also in the along a solid angle, so also in the sky. So that's basically a cylindrical integral, or in my case, I'm fitting a pressure profile and then doing a spherical integral. So it's like a temperature-weighted mass or a temperature-weighted densities is what you can think of for the SC effect. So strong lensing is another big piece of what I'm going to talk about here. And strong lensing happens which is that you can see multiple images of the same source or very extended image of the same source. Sometimes they join together when the surface mass density exceeds the critical surface mass density for lensing. And that's given by this equation. And in this equation, these d's, this is the distance between the observer and the source. This is between the observer and the lens, and this is between the lens and the source. So it does depend on the actual geometry of you in the cluster and the source that you're lensing. And if you have a source that is exactly behind a circularly symmetric lens, right in the middle, like this one, then the light will get deflected symmetrically all around. And so you end up seeing an Einstein ring, is what they call it. And the radius of that ring is given by this equation, where the radius of the ring is basically proportional to the square root of the mass that is enclosed by by that radius. And so the Einstein radius is kind of a nice observable, because you can picture what it looks like, but it also relates very directly to what the mass is, given that you know the geometry of the system, so you know how far away the galaxy cluster is and how far away the source is. Oh, and one other thing I wanted to point out about this diagram is that it looks, I mean, I got this from NASA, and it looks like the hot gas, you know, it's all on the same scale, that the lensing is probing the entire galaxy cluster, which is not true. The lensing really is probing the more central regions of the galaxy cluster, and the hot gas probes much larger scales. And that's important for later in my talk.
So why is that?
So it's basically because in order to exceed that critical mass density, you just have to have a lot, you know, it has to be very dense, and just the density profile drops off. So you can only really do that in the center densest part. But the SC is just proportional to, you know, the density times the temperature, and so you can just probe the bigger part of the cluster that way. It's kind of more, in that way, it's a little bit of a more sensitive measurement or something. Weak lensing only can probe the outer regions. So strong lensing can only probe the inner regions. Weak lensing can only probe the outer regions because you need the statistics. In the center, you just don't have enough galaxies, to like background sources, to be able to statistically put it all together to make a weak lensing map.
But I mean, it still measures like mass enclosed, right?
So yes.
Say it probes the outer regions.
It's still enclosed. Yeah, it's still the mass in the cluster. It's not like filaments or something like that. No, and the SC2 is also still the mass in the cluster.
It's the cylinder, right? For
yeah.
All
of these are projected, exactly. So the SC, so this is something that, so the weak lensing is projected mass, and the strong lensing is projected mass. The SC is kind of projected mass because it's weighted by the temperature. And so if you expect, you know, if you have a spherical thing, then that temperature weighting will make it less than just cylindrically projected. So strong lenses are very useful for cosmology for a number of reasons. One is that you can use them to measure the Hubble constant through time delays, basically a geometric probe. And you can also use them to study the faint, usually faint, but in this case they're very highly magnified background source populations. You can do hybrid shift galaxy surveys this way. But the thing I'm really going to talk about that I've been working on is that cluster scale strong lenses really probe the tail of the distribution of clusters. These are really the highest mass things in order to be able to exceed this critical density for lensing. So we're really looking at the most massive collapsed objects. And one nice thing about strong lenses and selecting strong lensing samples in particular is that dark matter halos that make good strong lenses, you can identify them from simulations using ray tracing techniques. And so then, once you have a sample of dark matter halos that are good strong lenses in simulation, you can look at what properties they have and compare with the properties that we observe.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So you mentioned there would be the highest mass, but it's really the highest density.
Yeah, it is the highest. It is the highest projected density.
But are they the same?
Yeah, typically. So like the most massive clusters in the universe are basically always strong lenses. If you look deep enough.
Because they're bigger, so. Because kind of your definition, the density is the same, they're all 200 pro critical.
No, that's the average density.
That's the average density.
So that's the average density. So a more massive cluster will have a bigger R200 than, But the mass will be different depending on, so it's really just one parameter, that's all. The mass and the radius are just related.
Wondering about this is that we know that smaller clusters have higher concentrations, so so they could be
so that could scatter them into the strong lensing sample, and those are exactly the kind of things that we want to test.
Okay.
So that's why it's so useful to have these simulations where you can say, okay, what clusters do make strong lenses? And so people have done this. I should put their names up. There they are. So these are all papers on simulations and theory and models that look at the ingredients that make a cluster a good strong lens. And so the first ingredient is mass. So people have found that really the most massive clusters, as long as there's, you know, a source behind it. And for example, if you picked the most massive clusters that we know about and did a really, really deep HST survey on them, you would find strong lensing features because they would always have something. If, as long as you get faint enough, you'll always find something doing that. But that's not really a strong lensing selected sample because it's also really hard to follow up these features for spectroscopy and stuff. But anyway, so the mass is really the main ingredient. But then there's also concentration. So like you said, something that's a little less massive but very concentrated can still exceed at the central regions this critical surface density. And another thing is if you have a, so we know that dark matter halos are triaxial. And if you have a halo that's elongated along the line of sight, then that, you know, increases your projected surface mass density. So that also will increase your lensing chances. One thing I wanted to note, actually, sometimes these work, you know, pick opposite populations from each other. So, like, if you have a more elongated thing, it's not as likely to be as concentrated or something like that. So sometimes they pick out somewhat different populations of clusters. But we would like to know what the relative importance of these different populations is in defining this strong lensing sample. Other things are like substructure. If you have clumps that that can near the cores, you can get more surface density in the, or a very massive brightest cluster galaxies, the BCG, or baryonic physics that affects the dark matter distribution at the center, or also surrounding large scale structure, you know, things that are projected along the line of sight of the lens. So some early studies have found that So if you look at the strong lens population that we know about, that's well studied already in the literature, you can measure the concentrations based on, actually these are based on combining strong lensing and weak lensing to get the density profile. And they've found that there's some tension between what we would expect from theory and what the observations show, such that the strong lensing clusters have larger Einstein radii, they're better lenses, they're more concentrated than we would expect from simulations. And but this has been a little bit disputed, and part of the problem is that these samples are small, and it's difficult to characterize what volume you're drawing them from and that sort of thing, and to put them in the context of the distribution of lenses you would expect. And so in 2008, Broadhurst and Buchanan recast this from a measurement of the profile from a concentration. And I should mention these, as you said, are all they're projected concentration. This isn't deprojected in any way. So they recast this from just measuring the profile to comparing the mass at large scales, the virial masses as they measure through weak lensing, with the core masses, which you can measure through strong lensing. And for the cluster, they observed four clusters that are well studied in the literature, and they find that they lie well beyond the predicted distribution in the standard lambda CDM cosmology. Oh, I'm sorry. So lambda is the cosmological constant and cold dark matter. So it's just the, you know, the standard cosmology that people run their n-body simulations in.
When you say it's well beyond, do you mean how well beyond?
So their discrepancy was 4 sigma. And okay, so I can talk about this more later, but basically the results that I show, we have a bigger sample, and we have the same magnitude of a discrepancy as what they saw, but we only have a 2 sigma discrepancy, and the reason is that when we are better characterizing the sample, and so we're actually simulating, like, if you draw a sample from the distribution of predicted from theory, how likely is that our distribution compared to the normal one? And they really were more, I mean, they only had 4 clusters, so they kind of said, oh, well, this one's 2 sigma off, and this one's 2 sigma off, and that's unlikely. You know, like, so they, you know, they had a smaller sample to deal with, so we are expanding on that. But yeah, they had a 4 sigma result. And so there were some possible explanations for this disagreement, that, and some of which are really pretty cool. So one thing is that in order to explain halos being more concentrated, you could say, well, maybe, so people see in simulations independently of this that when halos form earlier, they get more concentrated. So so you could say, okay, well, maybe halos are forming earlier. And what would cause that? Well, if there are some a couple different ideas. One is if you have early dark energy, then halos could form earlier, or primordial non-Gaussianity, they could form earlier. And another possible explanation is baryonic effects. If you have more interaction between the baryons and the dark matter, and the baryons are cooling, you could form cuspidor profiles. Or possibly the model, there's shortcomings in the models, so that it's not easy to get the dynamic range needed for these simulations, because they are very massive, rare objects that we need to also know what their internal structure is in their cores. And so a lot of the predictions are based on simulations done at lower redshifts that we assume things are the same at higher redshifts and that kind of thing. So maybe some of the modeling needs work. And another possibility is there could be more systematics than we are taking into account. For example, the projection. If the projection effects could be messing up the mass measurements or something, or maybe there's another selection effect that's biasing the mass measurements. Or finally, we don't really, like I said, with the problem with the last study, we don't really understand that well the sample population from which we're drawing these lenses. To address this question, we took a bigger sample, and that's kind of more statistically defined, of strong lensing clusters, and observed them with the Sinyavtsev-Zoldovich array, the SZA, and then we're using the SZ effect to measure on large scales what the mass of the cluster is, and comparing this to the mass measured on small scales by the strong lensing. And so this probes the concentration as that group set up. So the sample that we're using is actually from two programs. The first is the Sloan-Giant Arc Survey. And so these are galaxy clusters that are selected from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And they selected the richest clusters from Sloan and followed them up to deeper observations to look for arcs and identify strong lensing clusters that way. And then the second is the Red Sequence Cluster Survey, which is actually based on the imaging data of the survey itself. And they're both optically selected clusters. And they're identified through red sequence techniques, which basically is that you're looking for red galaxies in the same area and cutting down on the projection effects, as I talked about with the richnesses before. And the lensing features are identified visually with the selection characterized. So the same people looked at them and they characterized how well they did and if they flipped the images around, whether they found the lens again and again, that kind of thing. And so I followed these up, a sample of these, with the Sinyavtsev-Zoldovich array, which is an 8-element interferometer. Yeah.
So you mentioned they flip things around and look for arcs. Yeah. So there's no automated way that they have to.
There are automated ways of doing it, and they always have problems. I mean, so it's not easy to write a code, and your eye is actually really good at picking out this kind of feature, especially because there's not. I mean, that's basically the main thing. It's hard to do. And the automated codes tend to have, classifications that they miss, and it's just tricky and misidentify things. So they just did it visually. And, yeah. So my advisor sat there looking at thousands and thousands of pictures. And then they characterized, they flipped them around and graded themselves and various things. But the grades, I've been told, are confidential. No one's allowed to know who's really awful at identifying lenses. And you also use color information a little bit, too. The arcs tend to be bluer. They're star-forming things.
So how many astronomers clusters?
Over 100. And so it depends on how you define like your lower Einstein radius limit, basically. So some of them are going to be, really kind of just galaxy scale lenses, but the group is really focused on cluster scale lenses, but it's over 100. I followed up a sample of these with the SCA, and that's an 8-element interferometer in the Owens Valley, and it's now part of KARMA, like I was saying at the beginning. And we operate at 30 gigahertz and 90 gigahertz. That is me. So you can see how big the dishes are compared to me. I'm actually replacing a window in that picture, but I spend a lot of time there. So the typical observing configuration for cluster science has 6 of the antennas in a compact configuration, which gives most of the sensitivity to scales of like 2 arc minutes, and that's good for really measuring the SZ on this large cluster size scales. And then we also have 2 antennas that we space further apart, so that if there's a contaminating radio source in the cluster, we can simultaneously measure its flux using this higher resolution imaging data, and then subtract that flux out, or basically marginalize over it when we fit it for the cluster parameters, is what we do. So here's an example. This is a galaxy cluster from Sloan. And the scales on these pictures are very different. So this is 90 arc seconds to a side, and this is like 1,000 arc seconds to a side. But that's the SZ signal that we see. And I've removed 2 off-center point sources from the map using these long baseline data. So these are just showing the short baseline data. And you can see the big. So one of the nice things about this sample is that because we're selecting based on shallow imaging data, we only are finding things that have bright arcs. And because we have bright arcs for everything, we can do follow-up spectroscopy on them to get redshifts for the arcs. And that really helps in breaking degeneracies in the mass model. So for every cluster in the sample, we have at least 1 spectroscopic redshift for a source. So that helps with the mass modeling.
The arc is part of an Einstein ring.
Yes. So this is, yeah, exactly. This is like part of an Einstein ring. This is the giant arc, basically. And you can see, so there are different arcs, right? You can see these other arcs as well. And depending on the source redshift, they'll be, you know, nearer. They'll be bigger or smaller radii. So that's one of the things we do, actually, is then scale everything to the same redshift so that we're comparing Einstein radii to Einstein radii.
I guess that's a cool question about this
today. Yeah.
So you have 2 frequency bands. So
yes.
30 and 90.
And I'm only using 30 for these.
So you don't have the null.
That's true.
So does that mean that SCA is kind of limited to observing SCA of known clusters? And
no.
Discover
so the SCA was... The SCA was originally built to do a blind cluster survey. However, the limiting, so, and we did a blind cluster survey, and they just posted the paper on the archive after all these years, like last week or a couple weeks ago, like very recently. Stephen McCove is the first author. But anyway, they didn't really find anything. And one of the reasons is that when the SCA was planned, the sigma 8, which is the normalization of the matter power spectrum, was, we thought, much higher than what it actually is that we know today from other measurements. And so the survey area wasn't really big enough to expect to see it clustered to our sensitivity limits, sadly. So the SCA is kind of the precursor to SPT in a lot of ways, because it was going to like detect the first blind cluster. I mean, and I don't know, this is all very... You know, but then SPT ended up doing that because it just surveys so much more area. I mean, it's a survey machine. Whereas the SCA is really an interferometer that's really good for doing these pointed observations because you have this extra point source removal power. Whereas with SPT, they have done follow-up of known clusters, but it's really kind of a waste with their instrument because you just have this huge field of view. It's not really what it's designed to do, and you need to either scan strategy, needs to remove the atmosphere. Anyway, it works very well as a pointed observation instrument. It's too bad, though, that SPT is in the southern, is at the, you know, the South Pole, because we're in the northern hemisphere, so we can't follow up SPT-discovered clusters with the SCA very much.
Without the null frequency.
You don't need the null frequency. So even the SPT discovered clusters, the surveys that the catalogs that they've published don't actually use the null frequency really. I mean they're so basically every cluster that they publish is followed up optically, and so you need a redshift as well. And so all of the cluster candidates are confirmed by seeing, oh, look, there's a whole bunch of galaxies there. It's a very rich environment. And with these galaxy clusters, they're all really massive. And so you're going to have tons of galaxies there. Now, why wouldn't you just say, oh, why don't you just do an optical selected survey? And part of it is that your selection function is much cleaner this way. because of the drop-off with mass. So whereas with optical, you might have other less massive things that also have a lot of galaxies scattering up into your sample. So this is a much cleaner sample, basically. So those are, I don't know.
What does it mean to say you removed two off-center?
I cleaned them out of the map. So I fit a model, like a little Gaussian, and removed that model from the map. So it's kind of a standard interferometry trick that people do.
You are confident these are point sources for you?
Yes, yes. And they actually were not on the cluster center anyway. So that was fine. If there's a radio source that's extended, then that totally messes this up. Like, then you really don't know what the flux is, and I wouldn't trust the measurement then. But we haven't seen any that have really been a problem in this, certainly not in this sample. I wouldn't include them in the sample. Other groups such as Lin and Moore, Lin and Partridge and other people have found that in clusters, they've done studies with the VLA looking at the spectral indices of radio sources in clusters, and they find that typically usually radio sources are brighter at lower frequencies and fall off at higher frequencies. And what they found is doing lower, even lower than this. This is 30 gigahertz. They were more like 1 to 8 in a little higher gigahertz. They find that typically the extended emission has a steep spectral index such that there's not much flux at these frequencies. But the point sources, if there's something with an inverted or that kind of spectral index, then it's more likely to be a point source. So that's another little result.
Is it like a jet?
Yeah, lobes, jets, that kind of thing. But they're not that powerful. Certainly, I mean, the typical one wouldn't be that powerful at these redshifts in these clusters. Like, it's just not that much of a problem for us, luckily, because that could mess us up. Yeah?
I have a question about the SE effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's the
pressure, but yes, temperature times density, yeah.
And so from going from that to potential of the cluster, which is dominated by the potential of the dark matter,
mm-hmm.
do you assume anything about the profile of the dark matter?
Okay, so I'll get into later what I do in this tech. Like, so I developed, this method of getting to mass from what I observe with SE. So I have a slide on that. And if I don't answer your question well enough, let me know when I get there. But other groups do different things than what I do too. So SPT, for example, has a significance measurement that they use instead, which they're trying to calibrate according, against other mass proxies for sample of clusters.
Based on the assumptions you make, you might get different concentrations.
Yeah. So I don't actually. So I do measure. I'm fitting the data to a profile. So I'm fitting a pressure profile to these data, and then calculating an integrated Y parameter according to that pressure profile, spherically integrated one. And then, I'll go into more on the technique in like two slides, so I might as well just look then. This is a gallery of the sample. So very pretty SD observations, all at 30 gigahertz. And right, here's a slide. Okay, so right, we start with a pressure profile, which is based actually on simulations by Nagai et al. 2007. And we use this Monte Carlo Markov chain analysis to fit what parameters, to fit the parameters of the model. And then calculate an integrated Y based on those parameters. And then we do the exact same thing. So using the SCI, same instrument, same model, and same analysis software, everything exactly the same. We do that also on a sample of local clusters that we have weak lensing measurements for. And so we calibrate based on that, the integrated Y versus mass. We calibrate a scaling relation and use that scaling relation to calculate the mass for the clusters in our sample. So we're not actually assuming hydrostatic equilibrium. We're not really assuming that. We're just assuming that. Really, the main assumption is that our clusters are like those enough that we can do this. But one of the interesting things about this is that the local sample is not strong lensing selected, which helps us because, in some level, because if you think that the weak lensing measurements might be biased high or something like that, if they're elongated along the line of sight, then then that same bias won't be in what we're using to determine this calibration that we apply to our sample. So we're basically just using a scaling relation. It's empirical. We're not dealing with that.
So you're assuming no evolution?
We're assuming self-similar evolution in the scaling relation. And there haven't been many studies showing that we should not really assume that. So, yeah. So here's the sample. So there are some clusters that are at lower redshifts that have been quite well studied before, and then we also have quite a few higher redshift clusters in the sample as well, which is especially interesting because if these, especially these early halo-forming models, if those are really important, then you would expect this would really persist out at higher redshifts and would affect those clusters too. So I have a bunch of references for the lensing models. My collaborator, Karen Chiron, has done a lot of work on the lensing models. And so here are the main results. So this plot shows on the x-axis is the mass, and this is an M500 at an overdensity radius of 500 in 10 to the 14 solar masses versus the Einstein radius in arc seconds. And as I mentioned a little briefly before, the Einstein radius, we actually measure it by constructing a detailed lensing model. Basically, it's like the square root of the area inside the critical curve. So those are all kind of technical terms, but it's basically like the average Einstein radius for the cluster, given the geometry of the source, like where the, we measure that we have at least one spectroscopic redshift, so we measure the source redshift and the cluster redshift. And then we scale this Einstein radius according to the lensing model. We kind of move the mass to a fiducial redshift and put a source at a fiducial redshift so that we're comparing really the enclosed mass, the square root of the enclosed mass for all the clusters. So the redshift dependence is kind of taken out that way. And the lines here, so the solid line is the median relation from Ogury and Blanford 2009, which is a model that, and this line includes strong lensing selection. So any biases that might come from that because we're selecting a strong lensing sample are already included in this prediction. So the black line is the median for their prediction. The dashed lines enclose 68% of the models, and the 90%, and then the dotted lines enclose 90%. So you can see where our data lie within like the distribution that you would expect from their model. So I have also done a little Monte Carlo simulation of this, just selecting samples from this distribution. And with a comparable Einstein radius cut, so I'm kind of modeling I guess it's called Eddington bias in astronomy. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but basically any kind of bias from the Einstein radius cut, and see how frequently does a sample of our size lie this far away from the median expectation, and that happens about 3% of the time. So that's where we get about a 2-sigma result. Whereas if you just said, that point, they're all discrepant, then you would get a more significant result. So this is, we're starting now, move into this regime where we can actually do this kind of make this kind of a statement of how different are the distributions instead of just, so there is still a discrepancy. We still see that clusters are too concentrated compared to what models predict. And it's at, this significance. Yes.
When you fit galaxies with Lambda CDM simulations, there's too much dark matter in the core. In fact, there isn't any dark matter in the core of typical galaxies. But this is a problem with the core concentration. So I wonder if something similar is happening here.
You're saying the
cluster is not a galaxy.
Right.
Galaxy has the problems of the disk.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, the dynamics of the simulation. This is a problem with dark matter. It's been around for a long time.
So you're saying, but this is the problem that there's too much matter in the cores.
Yeah, but the matter is mostly dark.
Yes, there's too much dark matter in the core. Yes.
You showed the pi, and there's a little slip.
Yeah, for galaxies, I know. Well, there's more for gas. Gas is very unstable.
It's mostly dark matter.
Yes, it is
so
mostly dark matter.
This is a typical problem. I think one of the reasons for potential is that when you do N-body simulations with dark matter, the particles are collisionless. So you don't include barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is it's difficult to solve the Boltzmann equation.
Right.
And
galaxy cluster simulations have this traditional overcooling problem with baryons that we know that they're doing something wrong. But one of the things about this kind of work, so that might be the solution, right? Like it could be that we are not capturing with these models what's going on because of the baryons. That could be the solution. But another interesting thing is that these are large scales. So these Einstein radii, it's not just probing like the brightest cluster galaxy. I keep calling it the core because it is compared to the SC, but it's still a large portion of the cluster. And it's very massive in the center regions. So it really has to be affecting the dark matter. It's not really well explained by just saying, oh, it's just the baryons or something. There's a lot of mass here that needs to be here in order to explain these.
Yeah, because the problem is that dark matter doesn't know how to stay out of places where it's not supposed
to go. That's fair.
You construct theories to tell it how to get out.
Right.
They don't work.
Right.
But here, of course, they want to get.
We want them to get in. Yeah. We need it to be more concentrated. They're not where we think they should be. Exactly. Yeah. But here they have to be more concentrated. Yeah. So we're trying to figure this out by testing it and seeing how much this goes. So the next step that I'm the next direction I'm going with this project is we see in simulations and actually in observations too that dark matter halos are not actually spherical, which all of the stuff I said before was assuming spherical profiles. And simulations suggest that strong lensing clusters should be aligned along the line of sight. And actually the position of image locations and also types provides information about the projected dark matter distribution, which I'll show you a little more in the next slide. And the baryons tend to make the central regions more spherical. And so I kind of would like to see, measure the shapes through different observables in order to measure on different scales what the shape of the dark matter distribution is. So using SC lensing and BCGs.
These systems are very realized, mm-hmm. and been around a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's surprising that they don't have spherical symmetry.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I'm not backed up, apparently. I'm not home, am I? Yeah.
How do you know that on the flag?
So these models in the simulations, when they do projections of the dark matter halos, and they find that they look triaxial. So this is the paper that I will refer you to, the Jing and Suto 2002 paper.
You see that they're triaxial.
Yeah, in simulations.
Simulations.
Yes, in simulations.
You can't trust those.
Okay, well, we're trying to make them better by addressing them with observations and saying they don't match, these match us.
Hmm? You have to be careful what you mean by see.
Oh, yeah. Simulated dark matter halos. Yeah.
This is a model-dependent statement. Because I wouldn't expect them to be triaxial.
No, I think you should ask.
Hmm?
You should.
Why?
Because if they are collisionless, then they're typically triaxial. Yeah. So you can generate solutions that are triaxial. I mean, a sphere is a special case, right? So it's only collision on objects that the spherical, like,
okay. So yeah, and that partly it ties into that the baryon cooling tends to make halos more spherical. So here are from simulations some predictions for the locations of the images around. So in the top panel, you can see that the lensed images tend to form along the major axes of the projected dark matter halos. And this does change when you add a BCG point mass to the center, but basically just the lensed image positions themselves are already a way to start to probe the ellipticity of the of the dark matter distribution on that scale. And so the plot that I just showed, those same simulations give these black line predictions for the angle between simulated dark matter halos and the arc placement. And then this is a very preliminary result that we also looked at the angle between BCGs and arcs. So this is not dark matter, but BCGs. It's not apples to apples here. But we see that they kind of follow a similar distribution. And so I'm currently going into this in some more detail and also adding the SC measurements. So this is kind of a very new measurement that, I mean, this is experimental and no one really has done this before with SC. This is a new thing to use SC for, to measure the shapes. And so I've fit elliptical models for the pressure to these to the SC observations, and it works, which is kind of cool. So like you can see that typically the SZ shape and the BCG shape tend to be aligned, and they also tend to predict where the images form. So this is new and kind of cool. And so this is another way to go beyond the spherical mass measurements is that, so SZ and X-ray depend differently on the density. And so when you combine them, you can measure the elongation. Actually, people do this to measure the Hubble constant if you assume a sphere or if you average over a bunch of clusters. But you can also, one of the things that bothers them is if they're elongated along line of sight. So so we're actually using this to measure the elongation for this cluster. I've reduced X-ray data and SC data and combined it to get that the line of sight elongation is about 1.3. And this is interesting because this cluster is in the plane of the sky, the elongation is more like 2:1. So major axis actually isn't aligned along the line of sight, which theory suggests typically that it would be for strong lenses, especially very large strong lenses like this one. So this will be interesting to try to pursue further for the couple of clusters that have X-ray data available for them. Another thing I wanted to mention about this is that there's been a lot of kind of excitement in the cluster community lately about finding clusters that are kind of too massive at too high of a redshift, and this is another kind of candidate for that, which is interesting when people talk about non-Gaussianity, but I'm not going to get into that because it's very complicated and not always done correctly, so I'm told. So another project that I'm going to talk about on the radio, the radio content of galaxy clusters is that, as I mentioned before, sometimes radio sources can contaminate the SC signal at these, lower wavelengths where we're looking for a decrement. So one motivation for conducting these big SC surveys is that the SC is redshift independent. As you saw in the equation before, there wasn't a redshift term in it. And so this is a nice graphic where you can see for three different clusters, that's the SZ emission, and in the inset is X-ray emission, which suffers from surface bright, cosmological surface brightness dimming. People want to take advantage of this redshift independence, but if you, there's some early evidence, and also some evidence, for example, in other populations of AGN, that the AGN, the cluster-associated AGN population could evolve with redshift. And so that could hurt your understanding your selection function for clusters at high redshift, which is very important for constraining the cosmological parameters, that that the high redshift clusters really matter for that. And so there have been some previous work to understand how much these radio sources can fill in the SC signal and contaminate your survey. Another reason that people are interested in this is that feedback from Radiolad AGN is one mechanism that's invoked to explain the X-ray properties of galaxy clusters. And studies find that most and maybe all galaxy clusters with cool cores also have radio AGN and vice versa. And so here's an image. This is an X-ray image where there are these cavities, and the cavities are actually filled with radio lobes. So we know that at some level there's some interaction going on between the radio emission and the X-ray emission of the intercluster medium. So in order to understand the effect of radio AGN on the clusters and on our ability to detect them in SC, we need to know how the population depends on the cluster mass and redshift. And so previous studies have really looked at large samples of nearby clusters and then tried to extend this to higher redshifts by using smaller samples, but in-depth observations of smaller samples of more distant clusters, and then compare them to the lower redshift studies that have been But now we have more uniformly selected large optical surveys of clusters, and so and they span a wide redshift range, so we can do this on a statistical level. So that's what I've done. And the samples I'm using here is the Red Sequence Cluster Survey. The first one is a two-band optical imaging survey, and then the second one is three bands. And so these are well-defined samples of clusters that that have been characterized within a cosmological context. And I'm basically finding the overdensity of radio sources around these clusters, so in excess of the background level, where the radio sources are taken from the first survey from the VLA. And so here are some of the results from that. So one of the things we see that other people have seen before is that the number of radio sources per cluster is a function of the mass of the cluster. The bigger a cluster is, the more radio sources it has. And so when you need to make sure you're accounting for this when you compare the high redshift and the low redshift samples. And what we find is that when we split into richness bin, which is our mass proxy, we find that the number of radio sources per cluster is about is basically constant between the high and low redshifts and from bin to bin. And there is the number of radio sources per cluster above the luminosity cut that I imposed so that we would have, we wouldn't be missing high redshift radio sources, is 0.03. And this result has already informed recent predictions for SZ survey contamination, and it makes it much better for SZ survey people. And so the one thing to note in somebody's birthday, in comparison, X-ray and infrared AGN do see a dramatic redshift evolution in the cluster AGN population over the same redshift range. And so this could indicate either two separate populations of AGN or possibly evolution between different modes of activity. And here's a plot from the X-ray AGN folks. So so here's like the low redshift sample and the high redshift sample, and they just see more X-ray AGN at high redshifts. So to further characterize the sample, I inspected the where the radio emission lies with respect to the galaxy cluster. And so, for example, in this cluster, these are two radio lobes, which in first statistically would be identified as two different sources, but I would say, oh, this is one radio loud brightest cluster galaxy.
So how did you follow this up?
I didn't. This is imaging data from the survey. And actually, there's two bands. I'm only showing one here. But I looked at... I just matched myself whether there is an optical counterpart for all of the radio galaxies. And I didn't do any spectroscopy on them, but I looked at the red sequence to see whether the galaxy that's the counterpart lies on the red sequence of the cluster. And I found when I do this that the fraction of clusters with radio loud BCGs, tantalizingly, is higher for low redshift richest clusters compared to the other clusters. And this is a two sigma level difference. And this is interesting in the context that that there is this connection between cooling cores and radio AGN. And there's also been recent evidence that by the Clinton et al. That the there aren't as many cooling cores at higher redshifts than there are today. And so this may tie into this picture where we have more cooling cores and more radio loud AGN and BCGs today. But we'll be looking into this more with the larger sample. So both of these results that I talked about were based on RCS1, which was a 90 square degree survey, about 45 of which overlap with FIRST, the radio survey. RCS2 is over 900 square degrees, so it's 10 times the area, so we'll have many more radio sources and well, many more clusters, and then we'll match with both NVSS and FIRST to gain an area there too. So here's some of the preliminary work I've done on that. This is a radial profile for the distribution of radio sources around the first ranked galaxies, so that's like the BCG, or the second and third and fourth ranked galaxies. And it looks like they're very strongly peaked around the BCG, and less strongly peaked but still peaked around the second, and then it kind of tails off. So it's possible that the BCG and the second may even be BCGs of projected of galaxy clusters or second BCGs or something, is very, very strongly and special, I guess is the word for it, with respect to the radio source population. So this I'll be looking into more with RCS2. And finally, to tie this all together, preliminarily I looked at the radio AGN activity in strong lensing clusters. And we find that strong lensing clusters tend to have more radio sources in them than clusters matched in richness and redshift. And this is kind of interesting in the context of the interaction between the baryons and the core and the AGN activity and the cooling of the gas. So it's, you know, this could tie everything together. That's tantalizing evidence as well. So in conclusion, the number of radio sources per unit cluster mass is basically constant over a wide redshift range, which is good news for SD surveys. And one exception to this is that the fraction of clusters with radio-allowed BCGs is higher at the 2-sigma level in the low redshift clusters. Strong lensing galaxy clusters tend to have larger Einstein radii for a given mass than lambda CDM predicts. And the BCG is frequently aligned with the SC. Images tend to form at the projected major axes. And so I just wanted to, you know, reiterate that we still do see this discrepancy in the strong lenses with lambda CDM that we're continuing to look into to see how that develops. Thank you.
Questions for Megan? So maybe I start and then you guys follow up. So these lines that you draw there, they don't include the observational bias. They don't.
They include strong lensing bias. So they've been included the effect of that we're selecting strong lenses. They don't really include. If there are some that we don't detect, and there were some that we don't detect in the SC. But those would only be way out here, actually, anyway, like the upper limits.
But this is a bit curious, because if there's observational, if you have an observational limit, you would expect this to be cut off somewhere. But you have a line there, right, in the prediction.
So there's also a line here. Is that what you mean? We wouldn't observe anything below an Einstein radius of about 10.
That's right.
So when I did the Monte Carlo simulation, I included that. Anything that was below that, we wouldn't be in our sample. Mm-hmm. So I included that when I made that calculation.
Yeah. Okay. So the correct thing to compare with would be your Monte Carlo simulation,
right,
as opposed to that.
Right.
Line.
Well, so this is. I mean, this is kind of. You have. I guess I could draw the line on the plot, but that you kind of draw it yourself. And this, the Monte Carlo simulation is really the how discrepant is this answer for these data. Mm-hmm.
Just a comment. Dark matter was invented to solve the missing mass problem. Mm-hmm. Now you have another missing mass problem.
I
know. Well, or you could say the outside is missing mass. So, I don't know. It depends on which way you look at it.
Because the Einstein radius is big.
It's too big.
So, this is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You say it's 4-sigma.
No, it's 2-sigma.
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 Oh, oh.
From... It used to be 4-sigma.
I know, it used to be 4-sigma, but now we modeled it better. But, so we are, I already, I have approved observations that we will be observing more of these strong lensing clusters this semester, actually, with the SCA. So statistics should get better. So if the same discrepancy holds, then I think we get up to about 4-sigma with the sample that we have proposed for. Right. Well, so then we really have to worry about more systematic effects. But I have collaborators who do weak lensing and who do velocity dispersion. So we're kind of going to combine all of these to really try to understand if there are any systematic effects in these. And then we'll really be in business. So, yeah.
So what is a typical temperature of the gas in the cluster?
So the typical, it's like a few keV in the X-ray. So, but these clusters, I don't even have X-ray measurements of most of these clusters, actually. But, yeah.
Is that actually well understood? I mean, how the gas is heated?
So the temperature has to do at some level with the cluster formation and the hydrostatic equilibrium, right? Like that's what you can apply hydrostatic equilibrium to measure the mass through the temperature. So at some level, there's one temperature, and you know, people in X-ray astronomy measure an isothermal model, fit an isothermal model to their data, but it's actually not totally true. Like the clusters aren't exactly isothermal. There are, you can make a temperature profile and it won't just be flat. But that they're really hard observations to do too, because you need a lot of X-ray photons to be able to do a temperature profile for a cluster. The X-ray masses, well, we don't have X-ray masses for these clusters, but for others, there's a paper by, it's actually the same collaboration that we have that did the lower, so this LOCUS collaboration is the name of the collaboration, and they, and that's the sample that we used to make our scaling relation from, and they've looked at the X-ray masses compared to the strong lensing masses, and they also find that the strong lensing masses are higher, but not that significantly. Is the answer. So they don't make a, you know, very strong claims about that. But they do find that they tend to be higher. And they also, one of their groups is really trying to start comparing the X-ray mass on the same scale to the strong lensing mass, which isn't really what we're doing. We're trying to, you know, use them together to get more of the profile.
The way they get this hot is through shock heating. It's a very different version of gas pulse. But that is exactly what you expect. That's that you can get order of magnitude this way, but the exact number is always. So other questions from Megan? And so she's going to be here, as I said, for the rest of the day, and you guys are welcome to join dinner with her, progress of the current 6. Let's thank Megan again.
Thank you.